Please acknowledge yourself.
I stand in opposition. I, Sarah Grimke. The words strained against my ribs and became lost. I wanted to refute what Catherine had said, but I didn't know where to begin. She'd ingeniously transformed me into an exemplar of goodness and self-denial. Any rebuttal I made would seem to contradict that and perhaps end my chances of being accepted into the Quaker fold. The thought of that pained me. Despite their austerity, their hair-splitting, they'd put forth the first anti-slavery document in history. They'd showed me a God of love and light and a faith centered on individual conscience. I didn't want to lose them, nor did I want to lose Israel, which I would surely do if my probation failed. I couldn't move, not the tiniest muscle in my tongue. Israel slid up on the pew as if he might stand and speak on my behalf. But he lingered there, balling his fist and pressing it into the palm of his hand. Catherine had put him in the same untenable position as me. He wanted to give no one a reason to question what went on in his house, especially the good people of Arch Street, who were at the center of his life, who'd known and cherished Rebecca. I could understand this. Yet watching him hesitate now on the edge of his seat, I had the feeling his reluctance to speak out publicly for me stemmed from something even deeper, from some submerged, almost sovereign need to protect his love for his wife. I knew suddenly it was the same reason he hadn't declared his feelings for me privately. He cast a tortuous look at me and eased back on the bench. At the front of the room, the female minister sat on the facing bench, along with the other ministers, scrutinizing me, noticing the glimmers of distress I couldn't hide. Gazing back at her, I imagined she saw down to the things in my heart, things I was just coming to know myself. He might never claim me. She nodded at me suddenly and stood.
"I'm in opposition. I see no reason for Miss Grimke to move out. It would be a great disruption for her and a hardship for all involved. Her conduct is not in question. We should not be so concerned with outward appearances."
Taking her seat, she smiled at me, and I thought I might cry at the sight of it. She was the only one to offer a dissent to Catherine. The Quakers decided I would depart Green Hill within the month and duly recorded it in the minute book. After the meeting, Israel left quickly to bring the carriage around, but I went on sitting on the pew, trying to gather myself. I couldn't think where I would go. Would I still teach the children? As Catherine steered them toward the door, Becky looked back at me, twisting against Catherine's hands, which were fastened like a harness on her small back.
"Sarah? May I call you Sarah?"
It was my defender. I nodded.
Thank you for speaking as you did. I'm grateful.
She thrust a folded piece of paper at me.
"Here's my address. You're welcome to stay with me and my husband."
She started to go, then turned back.
"I'm sorry I didn't introduce myself, did I? My name is Lucretia Mott."
Handful. In the workshop at Denmark's house, the lieutenants were standing around the work table. They were always by Denmark's side. He told them he'd set the date 2 months from now. Said there were 6,000 names in the book. I was back in the corner listening, crouched on a footstool, my usual spot. Nobody much noticed me there unless they needed something to drink. Handful bring the hooch water, Handful bring the ginger beer. It was April, and half the heat from hell had already showed up in Charleston. The men were dripping with it. "These last weeks you need to play the part of the good slave better than ever," Denmark said. "Tell everybody to grit their teeth and obey their owners. If somebody was to tell the white folks a slave revolt is coming, we need them to laugh and say, not all slaves. They're like family. They're the happiest people on earth." While they talked, Mama came to my mind, and the picture I had of her was washed out like the red on a quilt after it's boiled too many times. It got sometimes where I couldn't remember how her face looked, where the ridges had been on her fingers from working the needle, or what she smelled like at the end of the day. Whenever this happened, I'd go out to the spirit tree. That's where I felt Mama the sharpest, in the leaves and bark and dropping acorns. Sitting there, I shut my eyes and tried to get her back, worried she was leaving me for good. Aunt Sister would have said, "Let her go, it's past the time." But I wanted the pain of Mama's face and hands more than the peace of being without them. I thought for a minute I'd slip out and go back to the spirit tree, take my chance going over the gate before dark. But Mrs. had caught me slipping over it last month and put a gash on my head that was just scabbing over. She told Sobby, "If Handful gets out again without permission, I'll have you whipped along with her." Now he had bug eyes in the back of his head. I tried to set my mind on what the men were saying. "What we need is a bullet mold," Denmark said. "We got muskets, but we don't have musket balls." They went down the list of weapons. I'd known there'd be blood, but I didn't know it'd run down the streets. They had clubs, axes, and knives. They had stolen swords. They had kegs of gunpowder and slow fuses hid under the docks they meant to set off round the city and burn it to the ground. They said a blacksmith slave named Tom was making 500 pikes. I figured he had to be the same Tom, the blacksmith, who made Mama's fake slave badge back when she'd started hiring herself out. I remembered the day she'd showed it to me. That small copper square with the pinhole at the top said, "Domestic Servant, number 133, year 1805. I could see all that, but I couldn't get Mama's face to come clear. I had a tiny jay feather down in my pocket I'd picked up on the way over here, and I pulled it out and twirled it between my fingers. Just something to do, and the next thing I was thinking about was the time Mama saw a bird funeral. When she was a girl, she and my granny Mama came on a dead crow lying under their spirit tree. They went to get a scoop to bury it, and when they came back, 7 crows were on the ground circling round the dead bird, carrying on. Not caw, caw, but zeep, zeep, a high-pitched cry like a mourning chant. My granny Mama told her, see, that's what birds do. They stop flying and hunting food and swoop down to tend their dead. They march round it and cry. They do this so everything know. Once this bird lived, and now it's gone." That story brought the bright red of Mama back to me. Her picture came perfect in my mind. I saw the yellow parch of her skin, the calluses on her knuckles, the gold-lit eyes, and the gap in her teeth, the exact wideness of it. "There's a bullet mold at the city arsenal on Meeting Street," Gullah Jack said. "But getting in there, well, I don't know." "How many guards they got?" Rolla asked. Gullah Jack rubbed his whiskers. 2, sometimes 3. The place has the whole stockpile of weapons for the guard, but they're not letting one of us stroll in there." "Getting in would mean a fight," Denmark said. "And that's one thing we can't afford. Like I said, the main thing now is not to rouse suspicion." "What about me?" I said. They turned and looked at me like they'd forgotten I was in the room. "What about you?" said Denmark. "I could get in there. Nobody looks twice at a slave woman who's lame in one leg."
Sarah. As dusk hovered, I sat at the desk in my room and slid open a letter from Nina. I'd been at Green Hill almost a year, and I'd written her every month without fail. Small dispatches about my life and inquiries about hers. But she'd never replied to any of them, not one. And now here was an envelope with her large calligraphy, and I could only imagine the worst. 14 March, 1822. Dear sister, I've been a poor correspondent and a poorer sister. I didn't agree with your decision to go north, and I haven't changed my mind about it, but I have behaved badly, and I hope you will forgive me. I'm at my wit's end about our mother. She grows more difficult and violent each day. She rants that we've been left without sufficient means to live, and she blames Thomas, John, and Frederick for failing to take care of her. Needless to say, they come in frequently, and Mary never comes, only Eliza. Since your departure, Mother spends most of her day shut in her room, and when she emerges, it's only to rage against the slaves. She swings her cane at them over the least thing. She recently hit Aunt Sister for nothing more than burned loaves of bread. Last evening, she struck Handful when she spotted her climbing over the back gate. I should add that Handful was climbing into the workyard, not out of it. And when Mother asked for an explanation, Handful said she'd seen a wounded pup in the alley and gone over the gate to help the creature. She insisted she was returning from that momentary mission of mercy, but I don't think Mother believed her. I certainly didn't. Mother broke the skin over Handful's brow, which I bandaged the best I could. I'm alarmed at Mother's escalating temper, but I also fear Handful is engaged in something dangerous that involves frequent trips over the gate. I saw her slip away from the house myself on another occasion. She refuses to speak to me about it. I doubt I can shield her if she's caught again. I feel alone and helpless here. Please come to my aid. I beg you. Come home. Yours in need and with sisterly love, Nina. I laid down the letter. Pushing back the chair, I went to the dormer window and stared at the darkening grove of cedars. A little swarm of fireflies was rising up from it like embers. I feel alone and helpless here. Nina's words, but I felt them like my own. Earlier, Catherine had sent my trunk up from the cellar, and I busied myself now pulling belongings from the wardrobe and the desk, strewing them across the bed and onto the braided rug. Bonnets, shawls, dresses, sleeping gowns, gloves, journals, letters, the little biography of Joan of Arc I'd stolen from Father's study, a single strand of pearls, ivory brushes, bottles of French glass filled with lotions and powders, and dearest of all, my lava box with the silver button. You didn't come down for supper. Israel stood in the doorway, peering inside, afraid it seemed to cross into my small, messy sanctum. My possessions were puny by Grimke standards, but I was nevertheless embarrassed by the excess, and in particular by the woolen underwear I was holding. He fixed his eyes on the open trunk, then swung his gaze to the eaves as if the sight of my packing stung him. I had no appetite, I said. He stepped finally into the disarray. I came to say, I'm sorry. I should have spoken in the meeting. I was wrong not to. What Catherine did was unpardonable. I've told her as much. I'll go before the elders this week and make it clear I don't wish you to leave. His eyes gleamed with what I took to be anguish. It's too late, Israel. But it isn't. I can make them understand. No! It came out more forcefully than I intended. He sank onto the end of my narrow bed and plowed his hand through his rampant black hair. It filled me with a sharp, almost exquisite pain to see him on the bed, there among my gowns and pearls and lava box. I thought how much I would miss him. He stood and took my hand. You'll still come and teach the girls, won't you? A number of people have offered to board you. I pulled my hand away. I'm going home. His eyes darted again to the trunk, and I watched his shoulders curve forward, his ribs dropping one onto the other. Is it because of me?
I paused, not knowing how to answer. Nina's letter had come just when the bottom had fallen from things, and it was true, I welcomed the excuse to leave. Was I running away from him? No, I told him. I was sure I would have left regardless. Why dissect the reason? When I recounted the contents of the letter, he said, "It's terrible about your mother, but there must be other siblings who can tend to the situation." Nina needs me, not someone else. But it's very sudden. You should think about it. Pray about it. God brought you here. You can't deny that. I couldn't deny it. Something good and right had brought me north, and even to this very place, to Green Hill and Israel and the children. The mandate to leave Charleston was still as radiant as the day I'd first felt it. But there was Nina's letter lying on the desk. And then there was the other matter, the matter of Rebecca. Sarah, we need you here. You've become indispensable to all of us. It's decided, Israel. I'm sorry. I'm going home to Charleston. He sighed. At least tell me you'll come back to us after things are settled there. The window was sheened with the glare of the room, but I stepped close to it and bent my head to the pane. I could see the bright helix of fireflies still out there. I don't know. I don't know anymore.
Handful. The night before I went to the city arsenal to steal a bullet mold, me and Goodis crept up to the empty room over the carriage house, the same one where me and Mama used to sleep, and I let him do what he'd been wanting to do with me for years, and I guess what I'd been wanting to do with him. I was 29 years old now, and I told myself, if I get caught tomorrow, the guard will kill me, and if they don't, the workhouse will, so before I leave the earth, I might as well know what the fuss is about. The room was empty, except for a straw mattress Sarby had laid on the floor for Minta and him, but the place still had the same old fragrance of horse shit. I looked down at the grungy mattress, while Goodis spread a clean blanket across it, smoothing out every little wrinkle just so. And seeing the care he took with it, I felt tenderness to him pour through me. He wasn't old, but most of his hair was gone. The lid over his wandering eye drooped, while the other lid stayed up, so he always looked like he was half asleep. But he had a big, easy smile, and he kept it on while he helped me out of my dress. When I was stretched out on the blanket, he gazed at the pouch around my neck, stuffed fat with scraps of the spirit tree. "I don't take that off," I said. He gave it a pinch, feeling the hard lumps of bark and acorns. "These your jewels?" "Yeah, those are my gemstones." Pushing the pouch to the side, he held my breasts in his hand and said, "These ain't big as two hazelnuts, but that's how I like 'em, small and brown like this." He kissed my mouth and shoulders and rubbed his face against the hazelnuts. Then he kissed my bad foot, his lip following the snarled path of scars. I wasn't one to cry, but tears leaked from the sides of my eyes and ran behind my ears. I never spoke a word the whole time, even when he pushed inside me. I felt like a mortar at first, and he was the pestle. It was like pounding rice, but gentle and kind, breaking open the tough hulls. Once he laughed, saying, "This what you thought it'd be?" And I couldn't answer. I smiled with tears seeping out. The next morning, I was sore from loving. At breakfast, Goodis said, "It's a fine day. What you think, handful?" "Yeah, it's fine. Tomorrow gonna be fine, too." "Might be," I said. After the meal, I found Nina and asked her could I have a pass for the market. Sabi wasn't in a granting mood. I told her, Aunt Sister says molasses with a little whiskey would do your mama a world of good. Might calm her down, but we don't have any. She wrote the pass, and when she handed it to me, she said,